Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
My new book, Diary of a Psychosis, is out. It's the most lively, devastating baseball bat to the throat takedown of what the public health establishment did in 2020 and beyond that you can imagine. It's my first book in 9 years, and you're going to love it. Check it out at diaryofcovid.com. And if you've already bought it, make sure also to visit diaryofcovid.com so you can claim your free bonuses, including my free companion volume, Collateral Damage, a collection of stories from real people who suffered under the restrictions. They weren't allowed to tell their stories at the time, but every one of them told me, "We just want to be heard." Check it all out at diaryofcovid.com. Hey, everybody, welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 2457. I'm here with Jeff Deist, whom you remember as president of the Mises Institute. He's now with Monetary Metals, and we have not spoken to him for quite some time. So I'm very glad to have a chance to do that and catch up with him on what's going on in the world, particularly with emphasis on money and its debasement and what we're living through at the moment. So delighted to welcome you back, Jeff.
Yeah, Tom, I think it's been maybe a year.
That's inconceivable to me. So I'll never make that mistake again. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about what's been happening with money. Everybody knows prices have been rising. And also everybody knows that there's been controversy about this, whether this would be just a temporary thing, whether it instead portends a long period of price inflation. Well, at this point, I think we can say that if you were claiming it was temporary, then your definition of temporary is different from that of most people. So let me start, though, with a little bit of devil's advocate, because I've had, as you know, I've had Gene Epstein on a number of times.
And
in recent times, he has come on to contradict some of the sky is falling people on inflation, to say he doesn't deny there's price inflation. He doesn't deny that in particular sectors, it could be at a point where it is very disruptive to people's lives, but he's not buying into the whole the current generation has it uniquely badly line of argument. He says, I can point to all kinds of data showing that that's not the case. But by contrast, I've had Peter St. Ange from the Heritage Foundation on, who really does say something like the opposite. This really, really is a challenge to the rising generation, to the middle class. So where do you come down on this?
Well, I would have to say that my sympathies lie with Peter St. Ange on this matter. Obviously, Gene has been talking about this for years, really. This idea that the middle class is being hollowed out by the financialization of the economy, which is something I think in Austrian and hard money circles, we like to think about that. And Gene has said, no. When you actually compare disposable income, when you compare living standards, where you know the sky is not falling, and the Austrian libertarian types are overstating the case. Well, I think there's a couple problems with that. First of all, we live in an era where basic things that our grandparents and our parents took for granted, like buying a house, getting a certain job, maybe getting married, are no longer things that young people can take for granted. So I really do think that, especially in housing, young people have gotten a bad deal. And by young, we could say really anybody under 40 at this point. So there really is a profound and marked difference in the housing market since Gene was a young man. And there's a lot of reasons for that. We can't lay all of that at the feet of the Fed, of course. We need far more houses and far cheaper houses in the United States. And that goes to things like the regulatory superstructure and zoning and other things beyond just central banking and interest rates. But nonetheless, it is harder, I believe, for young people today. And I also think Gene perhaps discounts some of the hidden measures of inflation, some of the hidden taxes that we're all paying on things that aren't so obvious and that aren't necessarily captured in, let's say, BLS statistics, certainly are not captured in the particular CPI statistic. And, you know, that's things like insurance. Homeowners insurance has been rising radically. Car insurance has been rising radically. Health insurance has been rising radically. And of course, everyone either rents or pays a mortgage. So we're all going to absorb that cost in some sense. School and private school and college tuitions have been rising radically. Those co-pays you pay at the doctor have been rising. Pharmaceutical prices have been rising. So there's a lot of other factors that underpin our material lives apart from simply, let's say, the cost of gasoline or the cost of a gallon of milk or a loaf of bread. So it's not so simple to compare across eras. And I think while Gene makes some good points, I think we also have to understand that this is a bit of an apples and oranges comparison, especially with respect to, let's say, housing and automobiles. I mean, the houses our great-grandparents bought in, let's say, the 1930s and 40s were much smaller. If you go to one of the surviving houses today, you'll see the closets are tiny. They maybe had no garage or a single car garage. And the building materials were more rudimentary. You can't really compare that to a 3,000 square foot McMansion today with two air conditioning compressors and all kinds of foam insulation and granite countertops and things like that. So it's an apples and oranges comparison for housing because we've simply gotten used to having fancier houses. And I think the Fed has something to do with that. Similarly with automobiles, if you compare a 2024 Toyota Camry to the 1970-something Dodge Dart that my dad bought, they're really not the same thing. I mean, that Dodge Dart wouldn't even go 100,000 miles probably in terms of safety, reliability, fuel efficiency, just the comfort of the car, the way it rides. Modern cars are marvels. So they cost a lot more, but they're also really a different good in many ways.
But in parentheses, though, isn't it a shame that the basic model that some people would consider perfectly adequate, and obviously millions and millions of people lived with them perfectly happily in previous generations, is not available for whatever reason? And when I say whatever reason, I mean probably they're increasing requirements for these cars. They have to do this, they have to do that, they have to get this gas mileage, and then it becomes hard to get that entry-level car.
Well, in vast parts of Asia and the third world as well, you can buy very stripped down new cars, oftentimes from Chinese manufacturers, but even from Japanese manufacturers. Like the Toyota Land Cruiser has a version that sells overseas that has roll-up windows, that doesn't have airbags, it's much lighter. As a result, of course, it gets better mileage than it otherwise would. So a lot of this is the U.S. regulatory structure. You know, backup cameras are mandated, airbags are mandated. Everybody has automated windows and air conditioning and all these bells and whistles. So in part, that's not just the market.
So what you want to do is insert caveats about understanding that when we say a house in 1953.
Well, I want to do that. But really what I want to do is disagree with St. Ange and say, oh, my gosh, these young people are screwed and they deserve to be pissed off. That's what I really want to do, Tom.
Yeah. And I hear that. And the thing is, unfortunately, and to some extent, understandably, they're going to completely misdiagnose the problem. They'll think it's, quote, the system, which in effect, it is the system. It's just they're going to identify the wrong system as being the culprit. And this has been an issue. This has been a problem with the Fed since it was created, that the Fed creates all kinds of instability, creates bubbles, it creates prices that are out of whack, it artificially, I mean, for example, the whole war sector of the economy is made possible by the Fed. So it blows up parts of the economy that wouldn't exist at that size. And people think that's capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And no one says, but the Fed is doing this. What are the consequences of what the Fed is doing? That's just so off the table. So the Fed causes all this mischief and the market economy gets the blame.
Well, and let's also lay some of the blame at the feet of economists themselves. Professional economists, academic economists, because their entire job as social scientists is in part to help us understand the unseen, the seen and the unseen. We're all familiar with that concept. Of course, Per Bylund wrote a book with that title, The Seen and the Unseen, because it's very easy for a young person to become disillusioned with, let's say, their job prospects, their student loan debt, their housing availability, all these kind of things, and to look at the landscape and say, well, I'm going to vote for Bernie Sanders or someone like that. I want student loan forgiveness. I want rent control. I want food stamps. I want free health care. I want to go to grad school for free. I mean, you can understand why people would gravitate towards this mindset because that's the scene. It's very easy for government to take money or borrow money or print money and create some of these scene effects and say, okay, we're going to build a housing subdivision for poor people. That's going to be brick and mortar. You can see that. So a brick and mortar housing development, let's say built by a city government in a place like Chicago, that's visible to people. They can see that. They can understand that someone can actually live in it. But what they can't see and understand so easily is the opportunity costs of that money or those taxes or that debt to the city and what else could have been done in the marketplace. So it's a real problem for those of us who are more in the Austrian or libertarian side of things to explain to people the second and third order effects of what the Fed does. And what we really have to understand And I think this goes so unbelievably unremarked, is how unusual the last four decades have been in human history. If you look at the period from roughly 1982 to 2022, not only the United States, but really across the West, central banks pushed interest rates down and down and down, not in a linear fashion, but generally speaking, over 40 years. So what does that do? What happens when you spend four decades making credit cheaper than it otherwise would be, at least in our opinion, in the view of a lot of critics of the Fed? What happens when the most important price in the economy, the price of borrowing money or the price of saving, is, I'm not going to say set by a central bank, I'm going to say it's targeted and influenced by a central bank. Now, what happens? I mean, that's the question that David Stockman asks in The Great Deformation. I would argue that what happens is actually very profound, that saving becomes less and less attractive to people, borrowing becomes more and more attractive to people, and that filters out, that flows through the economy in ways which are just absolutely remarkable, in ways we don't think about too much. Maybe people buy that BMW instead of that Ford Taurus because interest rates are low and they can get a 0 or 1% car loan. You can't get that today, but you could a while back. Maybe they live in a fancier, larger house than they otherwise would. Maybe they take vacations in Europe instead of driving to the Grand Canyon. Maybe they send their kids to a more expensive college than they otherwise would, because anybody can get a student loan. It's really remarkable if we start to think about the cultural and social ramifications of monetary and fiscal policy beyond just the economics of it. And, you know, there have been some attempts to touch on this. Obviously, Guido Holzman wrote a book, The Ethics of Money Production, which is really fascinating.
Yeah,
I'd love to see that updated to account for the moral hazards surrounding the 2008 bailouts and for the unbelievable, extraordinary monetary and fiscal policy that accompanied COVID in 2020. I mean, the rent moratoriums, not from the housing authority, but from the CDC. I mean, what does that mean when you tell people that they don't have to pay their rent for an extended period, that they don't have to pay interest on their student loans or mortgages for an extended period? How does that moral hazard flow through the economy? What does it mean to landlords? What does it mean to the so-called rule of law when you purchase, let's say, a townhouse or a condominium as a rental property for extra income, thinking that, well, if I don't get paid rent in my town, I can go to the, you know, local court system, use the eviction process and have the people out, let's say within a month, at not too much legal expense to myself, and I can fix it up and rent it again. I mean, that's a presumption. We all think of contracts in America as something that are enforced. But what happens when a rent moratorium comes along because of a virus, because of a flu virus? I mean, the ramifications of that are going to be huge. We're already seeing that. We're already seeing a lot of individuals getting out of owning housing, especially the Airbnb and VRBO market. And we're seeing larger corporate players, you know, the boogeymen like BlackRock, coming in and purchasing up more of that housing stock. So we have to, I think, view this stuff through a cultural and social lens, not just the lens of economics or finance. I also think we'll benefit from that, because I think the left does a very good job of coming at things from an emotive angle, from tugging on the heartstrings, from making populist arguments. And I think the libertarian right has shied away from that. And really what's going on both the fiscal and monetary side isn't just harmful to the economy, it's evil. It's contrary to human nature, to the whole thrust of human civilization, which is capital accumulation and cultural accumulation over decades. And when we start to mess with that, when we start to encourage people through policy to basically consume material and cultural capital rather than build it and save it, we're in trouble. And we're not just in trouble economically, we're in trouble, I would argue, morally.
All right, there's a lot to unpack about that. On the strict economic front, you were talking a bit about people making consumption decisions that they wouldn't make otherwise. And that reminds me a little bit of something Lucas Engelhardt says from, he's at Kent State, talking not about consumers, but about entrepreneurs. And the Austrian theory of the business cycle can sometimes be interpreted by people as meaning that because of artificially low interest rates, entrepreneurs suddenly become foolish. But he says maybe the better way to think about it is that foolish people become entrepreneurs. That, like, the analogy that's in my book, Meltdown, is Let's suppose you're choosing a bunch of players in your gym class to be on your basketball team. So obviously you pick all the best, and so the analogy would be the most credit-worthy ones. You pick them right away. And then if suddenly the coach says, oh, by the way, you can pick two more. Well, you know those two more are going to be worse than the first ones you picked. And so in the same way, what the Fed does is bring more and more people in who would have been passed over normally, you know, would not have met the requirements. So we have that. But then also in terms of this cultural stuff, yeah, I mean, I wonder if we can say at least something about the likelihood of settling down and starting a family. We hear a lot of discouraging talk about that being impossible. And then we get a lot of mockery from older people saying, well, if only you wouldn't go to Starbucks, you could start a family. But really, I mean, the expenses that they're looking at are very, very substantial. And yeah, I suppose if they sucked every pleasure out of their lives, they could be 3% farther down the road than they are. But I think some people are looking at the situation and saying, I don't see what the point is. I mean, I think some people, at least spiritually, in an interior sense, have more or less given up. Now, I can't prove that. I don't have any data, but that's my gut feeling. And that is no doubt anecdotal, but I think it's touching on something real.
Well, I think we all feel it. I think we sense it, that there's a profound shift in younger people. And there's a reasonable argument that says, look, if I'm never going to be able to afford a house, if housing prices are going to rise faster than I can save up for a down payment, why shouldn't I just spend more of my disposable income and enjoy weekend trips or whatever it might be, maybe lease a fancier car because I don't need to save as much. I'm not going to get married. I'm not going to have those kids who need to go to college. And we hear scary stories about how every child is going to cost you $200,000 by the time they're 18 or whatever it might be. And so this is all understandable. As for the baby boomers and their critiques, let's not forget, many baby boomers came from very large families of 5, 6, 7, 10 children and yet turned around and had only one or two themselves. So let's not accept too much scolding from the boomers. And also, I don't agree with this sort of right-wing push by the Ben Shapiros and the Matt Walshes to shame people. Oh, you know, you should get married. Don't listen to these naysayers. You didn't have to live through the Great Depression. I mean, every generation has its challenges. And I think this scolding is pretty hilarious. I think as people who understand economics, we should simply understand that incentives matter. And to a large degree, people respond to incentives. And incentives can actually provide us a glimpse into the outcomes. And so I really like Lucas Engelhardt's framing it. When you create an incentive through less expensive credit than otherwise would exist, you know, maybe foolish people become entrepreneurs. I think that's exactly right. But it's not just the foolish people who respond to incentives. I mean, if we go back to that really crazy period in the early 2000s, let's say after the tech crash of 2000, 2001, and before the big crisis of 07, 08, I mean, the downward pressure on interest rates was absolutely insane. And what that did, as David Stockman details for us again in The Great Deformation, is it created a merger and acquisition frenzy in the US that was really unprecedented because venture capitalists, private equity people, now these are smart people. They all went to Wharton and Harvard and Stanford, and they all have MBAs, and they all know how to crunch models in Excel. You know, really smart people looked at the landscape and they said, well, gee whiz, interest is so cheap that we can buy a company with just one or two parts equity, our skin in the game, and maybe 4, 5, 6 parts debt. And that was basically the private equity model for several years. And then the interest payments are deductible once we buy this company. So we can, you know, fire all the management and buy the company, use a lot of debt, deduct the interest, and then hopefully sell it in 3 to 5 years. So a lot of people looked really smart in that low interest rate environment. And a lot of deals on paper made sense. A lot of businesses made sense in that low interest rate environment. But it's like Warren Buffett says, when the tide goes out, we see who is swimming naked. And after the crash of 08, a lot of those private equity guys from Harvard didn't look so smart anymore. They had put their money into foolish things as well. So incentives matter. And if the right is getting anything right these days, I noticed you commented that CPAC just seems like a bizarro world at this point. Like they're not even talking about things that are even remotely relevant to people, like inflation or what's going on at their kids' school. They're talking about China.
Yeah.
But if the right has anything to tell us, you know, at the moment, I think it's this idea that we ought to use economic and fiscal policy to create the right incentives in society. I mean, is it really too hard to get conservatives to at least agree to that? Obviously, Trump and some of the new right are talking about populist measures, you know, protectionist measures and this sort of thing that aren't going to help. They're actually going to hurt. But, you know, it's good that we are at least thinking about the connection between economics and culture, between how people actually live, whether they behave more morally, whether they behave in ways that actually spread out and benefit society, like having families, like buying homes and being productive and creating responsible children for the next generation. We ought to be crossing this bridge between economics and morality and how people live. And that's, I think, a field which is remains wide open for economists. They don't like to do that. You know, economists, they, you know, we've become so, I guess, isolated that we don't have as much multidisciplinary writing as we once did because everyone's scared to go outside their lane and talk about sociology or talk about political science or talk about poverty or anything where, you know, PhDs who hyper-specialize in those things are going to jump down their throat for daring to even talk about this. But, you know, if you go back and read Mises and Rothbard and Hayek, they were not afraid to talk about the broader political, social, cultural ramifications of their work. And I would like to see economists start to push back a little bit and assert themselves and get out of this idea that they need to be just concerned with technocratic plumbing or mechanics and get back to economics as a real social science that's really about human interaction.
Well, amen to that. But this is true for history as well, my own field. They can't comment on anything beyond history, which means they barely understand history. But by the way, let's take 60 seconds, and then I have a couple more things I want to hit on with you. And people who have been listening to the Tom Wood Show for a while, probably somewhat familiar, but I do want you to at least say a word about what you do for a living now.
Well, so Monetary Metals is a company started by Keith Weiner, whom I've known for quite some time, and we're basically trying to take that $13 trillion worth of physical gold and silver, other precious metals like platinum, and put it to work. It's basically, even if you're Ben Bernanke and you think gold can never, ever, ever be money, well, it's still a capital asset and it still has a value. It still has, I would argue, a value well above just its industrial or jewelry uses. And so why not use all that gold to capitalize, to finance production? There's all kinds of businesses around the world, from insurance to mining to jewelers to refiners who need financing and are finding it very, very, very difficult in this current interest rate environment, which is so opposite of what I was just talking about in the early 2000s. So why not put all that gold to productive use and try to help some of these companies finance making stuff, making goods and services that we all need? So it seems like such a simple idea, but it's actually pretty radical in the sense that almost all physical gold just sits in a vault somewhere and does nothing.
So I've been, I guess, I don't know, what would you call me? A client, a customer, a member? I don't know what, but I have an account there, so I...
Kahuna, Tom.
Thank you. And by the way, they're not even advertising on this episode, but it is monetary-metals.com/woods, by the way, in case you're interested in this. Hey, everybody, quick word from Woods here. It's my goal to have the best supporters program out there, better than anything on Patreon or anywhere else. Support the Tom Woods Show, and not only do you get entry into my no-censorship Tom Woods Show elite group, but you also get the 16-page Tom Woods elite letter mailed to your home every month. Who else is doing that? This is all new material, completely different from the emails I send, and it is red hot. My supporters also get invites to my murder mystery dinner parties that I've been holding around the country. I'll be adding more cities soon to woodsmystery.com. I hold these in penthouse suites at luxury hotels with a beautiful catered dinner. It's a ton of fun. I also invite my supporters to my annual Christmas party, and the higher up you go as a supporter, the more things you get. Some supporters even get a small gift in the mail from me every month in addition to the newsletter. So go check it out, supportinglisteners.com. You will not believe all the goodies at supportinglisteners.com. And my profound thanks to all of you. So a couple of other things on what we've been talking about. One thing involves what you need to do with your money in order to prevent the erosion of its purchasing power. And a point that I've made for a while, which I think annoys Gene a little bit, Gene's ear is going to be burning for the whole day today, but is that, you know, in the old days when precious metal coins could be used as money, all you had to do was accumulate them and they held or increased their value. Now, you could also invest them if you wanted to, but you didn't have to do that if you had a very conservative outlook. You could just hold on to them and that was it. Whereas today, you would be an idiot to do that. You're going to say, well, I'll just pile up these green pieces of paper and then I'll retire and it'll all work out fine. No, it won't. Even if it's just 2% inflation a year. You know how much that is in 20 years?
We've done.
So the problem now is that, well, so now I got to get in the stock market. I had my 14-year-old just ask me about this in the car the other day. Why people invest in the stock market? And I was explaining it. And I said, well, one of the reasons is that there's an artificial reason that they invest now, which is they feel like they have no other choice. They got to put their money somewhere. And over time, over the 20th century, if you plot asset classes against each other, it has to be admitted that in general, not other stock markets, the American stock market has done quite well. So that has to be admitted. But at the same time, there are still some people who are very conservative who would even so rather not be involved in it because maybe they believe that the future is going to be different from the past. Or maybe they believe that because of their bad luck, they'll get in at just the wrong time. And then at the end, they'll be worse off than they were before. Whatever it is, Gene will say, oh, don't worry about that, Tom. Just put your money in a fund that's had good historical performance and you'll be just fine. I mean, maybe, maybe not. But the point is you have to think about your money more than you would have otherwise. And you have to consider all these options that you might not be qualified to decide between.
Well, that's entirely true. I mean, even brilliant, the aforementioned Wharton PhDs who spend 16 hours a day in the stock market sometimes lose their shirt. So what's the average guy or gal supposed to do? I mean, most of us are not wired to spend a lot of time studying financial markets. It's very difficult for average people, especially, let's say, elderly people, less financially sophisticated people, to have to go out and effectively chase yield, which is what you're talking about, because inflation is higher than our government admits. They currently admit to about 3.1% year over year in January 2024. But okay, I would argue it's higher than that. But my grandparents, by contrast, could simply go to work and save more than they spent. They could save that in dollars. And they could take those dollars and they could put them in really simple, safe vehicles like a savings account, like a certificate of deposit, and earn, I would argue, in their era, in their generation, a rate of interest that was appreciably higher than inflation. So without any financial knowledge or wherewithal on their part, simply by being thrifty and frugal, by working hard, they could save money in simple vehicles and get ahead. They could put money away for a rainy day for their retirements, perhaps to leave to their children. I'm afraid that's just not available to people today. They have to go out and do something with their money. They can't just sit on it in a simple savings account.
Exactly right. And then finally, another thing is, if you're trying to inculcate in your kids the old-fashioned values of thrift and delayed gratification, good luck doing that in an inflationary environment where all the economic pressures are on you to spend now because tomorrow you get less for the money.
At the very least, people can go out and get short-term treasury debt that pays over 5%. But Gene's idea that, gee whiz, why don't you just go find a fund that has a good track record? Okay, even if that's an index fund that's not managed, and even if it does better than inflation, again, it could change. That fund could have a bad year, could have a bad decade. So I certainly agree that U.S. equity markets, on the whole, on average, did very, very, very well in the 20th century. But if you happen to pick the wrong ones or the wrong fund, or if you have the misfortune to need liquidity or pass away in 1929 or 1987 or 2000 or 2008, 2009, well, all of a sudden the stock market is down 40% and you don't look so brilliant anymore. So the idea that our money is constantly eroding, and the left is open about this. The left doesn't want you to save money. The progressives say, no, you shouldn't be paid interest simply for saving your money. We need to stimulate demand, which is basically the mania of Keynesian economics in the 20th century, is that you build an economy through demand-side stimulus. So we shouldn't pay people interest just for sitting on their money. You know, people should lose money to inflation. In fact, we should even have negative interest rates nominally to force these rich guys to just stop putting all their money under a mattress or something. I mean, this is an actual line of thinking, when in fact, we know the opposite is the case. People ought to be able to just hold on to their money through thrift and be able to retire or leave something to the next generation. And when that's lost, I think America is in real trouble.
Well, you mentioned thrift there, and here's a problem. Try inculcating the old-fashioned values of thrift and delayed gratification in an inflationary environment. Your kids are not going to be as receptive because every incentive is telling them spend now, because if you try to spend tomorrow, you're going to get less. So there are a lot of different layers to this inflation problem. It's not just that I have to pay a little bit more for milk. The consequences of it are society-wide, they're cultural, they're long-lasting, they're invisible sometimes. And so it's all the more important for us to speak out about it, and in an informed way, not in a way that says, well, Trump could have solved this because he would have drilled for more oil or something. Which, by the way, I'm all for drilling for more oil, and I would prefer that. But this is not an issue of, well, one price went up, and that caused all the other prices to go up. That is not how it works.
Yes, and the idea that economics is a value-free science, of course, is true, and I agree with that. But that doesn't mean economists need to be monks somewhere. They can be out there. They can be connecting the dots. They can be building that bridge between what our government is doing to us and what's happening in the broader culture. You don't have to hide. You don't have to be value-free in your pronouncements. And I would just suggest that Peter St. Ange and E.J. Antoni, who are both friends, who are both at Heritage now, are doing an excellent job at that. I mean, they're using the modern tools at their disposal to communicate, which, whether we like it or not, are basically social media platforms. And they're getting out there in a pugnacious way that I think resonates with people. And I certainly would like to see a lot of our Austrians who so many brilliant people, so many brilliant economists surrounding, let's say, the Mises Institute circles. I would like to see more of them out there throwing punches, throwing haymakers, because this younger generation, they smell a rat. And they could just as easily go our way as Bernie's way. And I think it's really important that we're out there making a strident case and not a sterile, just pure economics case.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. So monetary-metals.com, of course, you can do /woods if you like, is
where you can... What happens when you do /woods? Tell me.
I don't remember because I didn't do it for my own. I signed up for the thing before there was.
Don't look into that.
I signed up for the thing before there was a /woods. You know,
maybe that
school
takes you to a secret part of the website, Tom.
That's right, a secret part of the. You probably are showered with precious gems, and who knows?
Exactly.
Who knows? But anyway, that's the link. We'll have it in the description. Thanks so much, Jeff. I appreciate your insights.
Yes, thank you, Tom. Great to see you.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.